Bandwidth for this podcast is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This week on the show, take down those payment walls. Journalists are now curators of content, and a chicken in every pot and a DVR in every home. All this on This Week in Media, episode 141. Hey there, boys and girls. We are back for another edition of TWIM. So thank you all for joining us. For those of you who are watching and or listening live on the TWIT network, welcome. It is always good to have you here and to sort of interact a little bit with you. And for those of you who will be listening later on during the week, thank you for listening and thank you for tuning in. We have a lovely, I am your host, Daisy Whitney, and I have a lovely crew with me today. I have some returning guests. I have some new guests. And before I tell you who is here today, I want to let you know that I will be on vacation for the next 2 weeks. I know it's devastating, Colleen. Colleen is here running the boards at Leo's studio, and she's a silent person sometimes that I chat with during the show. Colleen is like that naughty girl in class who sends you notes and tries to make you laugh when you're supposed to be paying attention to your teacher, and then you're the one who gets in trouble. Anyway, so I'm going to be on vacation for the next 2 weeks, and the lovely and wonderful Tim Street will be guest hosting the show. He's not on today's edition. I wanted to give him a little bit of break. He needs, he's at the spa right now. He has to get totally refreshed and ready to go. So I sent him on a 1 week spa retreat to prepare. Anyway, so the next 2 Mondays, Tim Street will be guest hosting, and we are hoping that Alex will be on those episodes. But as most of you know, his wife is due with their second baby any day now. So, you know, if Alex can make it, he can make it. If he can't, he will be involved with much more important things. So those are the housekeeping notes. Dr. Kiki is one of our lovely guests today, and she guest hosted last week and did a wonderful job. And for that, I'm so grateful. So thank you for coming back again this week, Dr. Kiki.
Thanks, Daisy. It's good to be back.
It's good to have you. And now you are doing a lot of things as always, but you're also very active on the Science Channel's Brink. And are you on today or tomorrow? I know you posted a note.
It's tonight.
Okay,
yeah,
so for those of you watching live, this is Monday, July 6th. So what time is it on for those people who are watching and want to set their DVRs or tune in later?
The show is on at 10:30 p.m., so depending whether East Coast or West Coast. Some people will be able to see it before I do. I think it comes on at like 7 or 7:30 some on the East Coast.
But it's repeated? I assume it gets repeated at some point. So just keep an eye out for it. And you're doing that on sort of a semi-regular basis, is that fair to say?
Yeah, a semi-regular contributor. And so I'm on with a piece on the Maker Faire tonight, and then I'll probably be back on towards the end of July with a little Brink Buzz newsy bit, and then on again in August talking about the National Ignition Facility and taking people on a tour of that amazing fusion facility.
Excellent. All right. Very cool. Congratulations on doing that. We also have Brian Stelter again. And you, Brian Stelter, is a media reporter with the New York Times. You were on vacation last week, so now you are refreshed and ready. I hope.
I'm refreshed. I left right after Michael Jackson died, and I came back right when Sarah Palin quit. So I was able to actually slip in a vacation in between the news cycle.
Isn't that great? Yeah, that is really excellent time. Or you can just say, you know what? I don't have to worry about this story. You had a nice story, though, and we'll get to it shortly. You had a nice story right before you left, though, about Michael Jackson and how that was covered. So we'll touch on that briefly. And then also, I think this is your first time, Chuck Joyner. Chuck Joyner is here on the show. He is the creator, host, producer of Mac Voices, a podcast, and was gracious enough to have me on his show a couple of times. I always have a good time on that show, even though everybody knows I'm not a Mac user. That doesn't mean that I don't have something to say. We didn't even talk about Macs. We talked about fair use. So Chuck, it's good to have you.
Thank you for having me, Daisy. We had a good time on Mac Voices. I know we'll have a good time here.
I think we will. And now, for those of you who may not be familiar with Mac Voices, in a nutshell, what's it all about?
Mac Voices is one of a series of podcasts I produce that focus on the world of Macintosh, everything for Mac users. Mac Voices is usually one-on-one interviews with people about what they do in the Mac world, Mac universe, I should say, their products, their books, their services, anything that's really relevant to Mac users.
And people might be wondering why he would invite an out PC user on a show. But we were talking about my ebook, Fair Use, because obviously a lot of folks who are creating content are doing it on Macs, and fair use and staying on the right side of the law is an important thing. So anyway, but enough about me. Let's talk about the news. Dr. Kiki, you sent me a really interesting story last week when I was prepping for this show, a Bloomberg piece on how The Simpsons are earning more on Hulu than on TV. This is really interesting. So the story said that TV programs such as The Simpsons and CSI are commanding higher advertising rates, basically a higher CPM, and that's cost per thousand, which is per thousand impressions that you get on Hulu and TV.com than they are on television. Advertisers typically pay $20 to $40 per thousand viewers for a primetime ad, and on Hulu, shows like The Simpsons cost $60 per thousand viewers. And there's a flip side to this as well, which of course is that there are a lot less ads on Hulu and other online sites, so you probably see three or four ads total in a show like The Simpsons, whereas if you were watching on TV, you would easily see at least three to four ads per commercial pod, of which there would probably be three or four in an episode. So there's kind of a flip side to it, but interesting nevertheless. What struck you about this report, Dr. Kiki, since you sent it to me?
Well, I thought it was really interesting that the basically we're looking at programming getting higher CPM, getting higher ad payments than on television, and that historically it's pretty much been that there's been the dollars to dimes, you know, media TV dimes.
Idea Zucker, where, yes, who said that? Yeah. Don't trade digital analog dollars for digital pennies.
Digital dot. Yeah. And so the idea basically that, you know, you have this general idea of more money going to TV advertising because it just has a feeling, or they've got the ratings that tell you you have a certain audience, but it's always been oversold and overblown. And it's been forever that we've been trying to say that, okay, here on the internet media world, you know exactly the statistics of the analytics of who's watching, when they're watching, how long they're watching, you know, how many people are watching exactly. And it should actually get higher payments, I think, but it hasn't. And so I think this is one of the first stories that's come out that's really suggesting that, you know, those digital dimes might be turning into dollars.
Now, Brian, if you have got a good spot now in your conference.
I was trying to get the perfect background here.
So you're watching Brian move around. I'm like, okay, that's enough. Stop now. What's your take on this, Brian? Because I think that this is... it's interesting, but it is also concerning at the same time. So do rates start to go higher to make up the difference, or is this just part of that inevitable shrinking? I mean, even though the rates are going up, sort of an inevitable shrinking of overall dollars, possibly.
Of overall dollars, yeah. I think we have a long, long, long way to go before the web makes up for TV, and I don't think we'll ever get there. I think what's more important is the shrinking overall of the ad dollars. And one example of that is this year with the upfronts. 2 months ago, the networks introduced their new shows, and we still haven't heard much about how much money they're bringing in advertising sales. It's been a really tough year for the TV networks. And so, you know, I personally hope that advertisers pay more for me on Hulu than they do on TV. I'm a lot more engaged on Hulu. Of course, now I'm going to forget the commercials I saw last night, so it's not really going to prove my point. Office Depot, I think, was the advertiser last night. Either that or Staples, so maybe it's not that much better. but because you're seeing the ads over and over and again, and because you are interacting with them sometimes, theoretically, you should be much more engaged. And so I certainly hope they're making more money off of me on there. I do think, though, this is the first of a series of steps, and they've got a long way to go.
Brian, what's the latest news from the upfront? I've seen a couple reports that, I don't know, maybe 3-5% down. But again, there hasn't been a lot of chatter yet in terms of how it's shaping up. Is that your impression as well? It's still kind of quiet?
The only chatter has been about how there's no chatter.
Right.
And about how it's been so quiet. And I think in the next few weeks, we're going to have to start looking in more depth at what's happening here, how low are the ad rates going to go. I think the TV networks are going to be very, very, very hesitant to give up any ground, but they may have to in this economy. We're going to find out, I think, as the summer goes along here.
Hey, Chuck, since this is your first time on the show, how do you watch TV? Do you are you cable, online only? What's your preferred viewing?
Daisy, I don't watch that much TV anymore, but when I do, it's usually something I've DVR'd on TiVo. If not, then I go to the web. And in looking at this situation, you know, I'm taking it as a user. I sort of felt like this was a tipping point, or one of the first ones, where the content, the choice, the availability, when I want it, how I want it, really is now going to start outweighing what all the networks are pushing out on their agenda, on their schedule to meet their, you know, their demographics or what they think are the demographics. So I thought this was very interesting and just maybe the first of things we're going to see as we move forward.
You know, here's a little sort of personal anecdote. I was with a girlfriend of mine yesterday and I was talking about this, you know, I get a lot of headaches. And the reason I missed last week's episode and Dr. Kiki filled in for me was because I had an appointment actually with a headache specialist. Great, you know, I definitely feel like there's hope on the horizon. But I was telling her about these different types of migraine medication that the doctor told me about. And I said, you know, and I'd never heard of them before, which is great. So which means I've never tried them before. So I feel like there's, you know, all these new options and things that I can take to kind of deal with it. She's like, oh, I've heard of that one drug that you just mentioned. She goes, I think I saw a TV spot for it. I go, you know, that's probably why I've never heard of it before, because I hardly ever watch TV. But it is sort of interesting. You realize that, you know, it's not just about paying, you know, paying the bills and everything. You really do. I mean, people who are regular TV watchers truly do learn about a number of new product introductions that perhaps those of us who are a bit more enmeshed in the internet world might not be hearing about. And hey, maybe we don't need to know about them, but it was just sort of one of those interesting, I don't know, just not a revelation per se, but just sort of interesting to realize where we're learning and hearing about different things. And that when you become part of the bubble that we lovingly embrace on this and other shows, we might miss out on certain other things. So now another story, also Hulu related, you sent this to me too. See, Dr. Kiki, I love you. You make my life so easy. You send me all of these stories and I don't have to do that much work. So thank you. I suppose my goal to have other people do my work for me. Hulu is now getting 10% of internet ad dollars. A report from Screen Digest. And Screen Digest is actually a pretty good research company to keep an eye on. Screen Digest has done a lot of terrific reports over the last year. I mean, Brian, you've probably referenced them in stories before. Screen Digest did a report on YouTube versus Hulu and ad revenue online. And this one said that Hulu, yes, that's correct. Hulu brought in about $45 million in ad revenue in 2008. And Screen Digest was saying that last year, overall, online video brought in $448 million. So that was about a 10% market share. I don't know, though. Is that $45 million, is that Hulu's, that's probably gross revenue, and then it starts to get split up. What is the cut? That how much of that is Hulu keeping, Brian? Do you know?
I think I don't think Hulu itself is keeping very much of that. I don't know specifically how it breaks down in that way, but I think that that number is still relatively small overall, compared to both the online video advertising market and then obviously the TV advertising market. How much Hulu itself pockets versus how much NBC, CBS, and ABC, I'm not sure.
Well, but do you know?
Not CBS, Fox, sorry.
But do we know at all, even roughly sort of what the percentage, what the revenue share is, even if it's not necessarily, even if it, whether it goes to Hulu or its corporate owners, but how much goes to the actual content provider? So if I'm watching like USA's Burn Notice, or even that might not be the best example because that's owned by NBC Universal. But if I'm watching, you know, TNT's The Closer or something on Hulu, how much of the Comfort In Spa ad that I just watched is going to go to TNT, and how much is going to go to the site and then get a portion to the corporate owners? Is it similar to iTunes? Is it 70-30 kind of thing to the content provider, even though iTunes is obviously a pay-to-play type of thing?
I'm going to go and try to find out, because I don't know how it breaks down in that way. My impression is that the actual content owners probably don't get all that much. I mean, there's more and more people in Hollywood that are more and more unhappy with online TV, because they don't think they're getting their share. But I'm not sure if it's 70-30 the way iTunes is.
Okay. All right. So we need to, that's something we should keep looking into. So, but yeah, it's a good point though that, and if anybody knows, because I get asked that question a lot. I was emailing with someone the other day that wanted to know that. And I think, you know, this is something I might ping Tim Street about this, because I think he's pretty good on this stuff, and he might know that as well. Maybe he can update everybody next week. But yeah, it's still not a lot in terms of, I mean, I'm not one to scoff at $448 million. I mean, I could take 10% or 1% or, you know, 0.5% and retire happily. But it's really not a lot to feed all of the people that are working in the online video business, right, guys?
Exactly. And there are, there are only a few of these sites. YouTube is obviously the biggest, and then Hulu's number two. If Hulu's only making, according to this report, $45 million in ad revenue last year, it makes me a little nervous. I mean, I'm one of the people that's been thinking that pretty soon we're going to have to pay for Hulu. And, you know, I'm personally very willing to open up my wallet and pay, but I'm not sure how many others are. Looking at numbers like this, I can see the rationale for charging for some of this content.
So speaking of charging for content, that's actually a good segue into journalism
perfect.
Online. And this is, and I don't just mean the concept of journalism online. Journalism online, which is a project from Steve Brill and Gordon Krovitz. Gordon Krovitz is a former Wall Street Journal editor. Was he the editor or the publisher? Well, he was a former bigwig at the Wall Street Journal. And now Journalism Online,
publisher.
I guess, is a platform. Thank you, publisher. That is designed to help web publishers, like presumably the New York Times or the Washington Post or whatever, sort of figure out how to charge for content. There are numerous ways to do it. Micropayments, sampling. This was an article that was sent to me by listener Daniel Drake. Actually, Daniel, I remember you saying that you first listened to Twim when you found it on the Twit Network. So thank you. He sent it to me from editor and publisher a couple of weeks ago. So I guess there's all sorts of ways that you could use this journalism online, use the journalism online tools, as I understand it, to set up some sort of payment system. Chuck, I would love to get your thoughts on this. I mean, you're kind of a new voice here on the show. And what are your thoughts on, you know, willingness to pay for news and information and editorial type of content online? I mean, I know a lot of us, you know, who are more regular on the show just very much feel that if we come to a site where we're not a paying subscriber and you can't access the rest of the article, okay, I'll go find the story someplace else. What is your take on sort of willingness to pay for different type of things, whether it's a micropayment? That's kind of an interesting concept.
Daisy, if I had the answer, I'd be a lot more frequent guest on This Week in Media. You know, I think that it depends on the credibility of who's creating it and what they're creating. Again, we're in an evolutionary phase here where everybody's sort of feeling their way along. The big guys have, theoretically, they have the credibility, which I'm not sure they do anymore, and that's a whole other discussion. But they're fighting people out there that are willing to create the content for free or for less. And the big guys have got to figure out a way to either be unimpeachable sources of information, or they have to be able to get it there faster than anyone else, which is increasingly difficult in a connected world. So I don't know. You know, the micropayments model, I like the micropayments model. And being a Mac guy, I have to draw Mac allusions. You know, I look at the 99-cent apps in the iPhone store and how well they sell, because they are almost impulse buys. And that was the same with the 99-cent songs. You know, if you see something or you hear something and it looks interesting, yeah, 99 cents, I really don't think about it. At $1.29, I think about it. At $2, I may move on. So I don't mind. I mean, I don't mind opening up my wallet to something that I feel is good. But like everyone else, I'm going to say, if it's you creating a Daisy, I might pay for it. If it's someone I don't know, then I may go looking for someone else I don't know who is charging less.
Would you pay 50 cents to read an article in the New York Times? Or I should say, what type of article would you pay 50 cents to read as just a hypothetical example? Brian, are you covering your ears or trying to hear better?
Yes. Sorry, Brian. I'm not, Daisy, I'm not sure. That's a great question. And 50 cents for me, for one article, is above the point. That's too much to ask me to charge. If you ask me to pay a dime, you know, 15 cents, maybe a quarter. But at 50 cents, you know, then I'm enough of an old, I guess, an older person that has bought newspapers, I start to think, wait a minute, 50 cents for one article?
Right, that's the whole newspaper not too long ago.
Yeah. So, you know, micropayments in my mind have to be micro, really micro. And that means that the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal or whoever have got to get comfortable with that concept and start recognizing that, you know, that's the way it's going to be. They're going to have to make it so cheap that I really don't think about it. And that because it's the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times, I'm willing to plunk down my dime.
Okay, Dr. Kiki, you were shaking your head before. So tell me your price sensitivity for different types of articles.
I think I agree with him there that 50 cents is too much. I mean, growing up, 50 cents was the price of a paper, a dollar is now the price of a paper, $1.25, $2. That's too much. And I actually think that unless there's some kind of a broad spectrum tool that basically takes a user into whichever outlet, so say like Washington Post, New York Times, Los Angeles Times, whatever, and you can go there and it's the same account and like it pulls from your account like a credit card or something, maybe that would work because you're not really aware of it happening. But if you have to say, yeah, I'll pay 10 cents, like I don't want to go through the trouble of clicking right on a button to do that. I would much rather say, these are the sources of information that I like, that I appreciate, and I'm going to subscribe to them. And I would be more willing to do that or even donate, you know, and go on a donation basis. I mean, I don't know when this article says that, I mean, how many people did it say are willing to donate? But
right, that according to an All Things Digital conference survey conducted by Penn, Schoen, and Berlin Associates, 92% of respondents said they'd be willing to pay something for online news. I don't think so.
And I wonder what that something is and what kind of news they're talking about. Like a penny. Yeah, right. Is it going to be a penny? You know, but it's worked for some people within, you know, the new media sphere to ask for donations. And I mean, it's when you ask, sometimes people really, you know, come forward and they say, I appreciate what you're doing and I will show it by giving you $5, $10, whatever I'm able to give. That's probably not going to be feasible on a large scale, but I think if you get people to pay $2 or $10 for, you know, $2 for a monthly or a weekly subscription or something like that, and you can pay on a weekly, monthly, or yearly basis, that might be something that's feasible. And it's probably only going to be the very credible, larger sources that are really going to get away with it.
And you know what? I think you brought up a good point. I mean, and we're just kind of talking hypothetically here, people. I mean, this is just, you know, I mean, these things aren't necessarily in place yet. But what I like is this reminds me a little bit of the Kindle example, where obviously, you know, Amazon has my credit card, and you know, when I make purchases on the Kindle, it just boom, it just dings at $9.99, and it's that sort of, you feel like it's just dipping into a little pool. It's kind of like the PayPal idea.
Yeah.
Now, when I send a manuscript or a file there, it's only 15 cents. So again, I don't think twice about 15 cents. That's not a big deal. So I don't worry if I'm reading a friend's, you know, novel in progress. If, you know, she makes a change the next day, fine. So I spent 30 cents. That's not a big deal. But what I like about it is the idea that it's sort of like a pool of money where you could say, if there were kind of like a universal account where just for one time, you know, you put in your credit card information or whatever it was. And then when you come across the article that you want to read that you're being asked to pay for on the Wall Street Journal, that's 10 cents or 15 cents. And it's just pulling from that same thing. So you don't even have to think twice about it. That's, I think, when this whole idea of micropayments, I think that's probably in the long run a little bit more attractive than a subscription model. I mean, what do you think, Brian? Yep.
I would love to have a micropayment account of my own, you know, where I could be pulling 10 cents, 15 cents at a time. I think among all the talk of paywalls, we have to think about these temporary paywalls, because there are times where I would pay a dollar or $2 or $3 for an article. And the best example I can think of right now is Vanity Fair and the article about Sarah Palin. I had not, when Sarah Palin stepped down on Friday, there was all this talk about this amazing Vanity Fair article going into crushing detail about what it was like for her on the campaign and some of the former aides accusing her of having mental illness. At that point, I would have paid $3 to read that 6-page story online. I wouldn't have ever bought an account for Vanity Fair otherwise, but I would have bought it that day. Then probably Saturday, I would have paid $2. Sunday, I would have paid $1. Now I'd pay 25 cents. I think we have to think about those temporary paywalls, because there's very little news that's actually it's so exclusive that you'd pay that much money for. But that's a case where you would. Yeah. TMZ, the day Michael Jackson died, I would have paid more for that than on Saturday or Sunday. So I think there are ways where you can get a little more than just chump change out of us, but it might be in very kind of specific time periods. Otherwise, I think it's micropayments.
Dr. Kiki.
Yeah, and I think this is really interesting. You know, looking at it, the scientific journals have been charging for individual downloads of PDFs of scientific articles for years, and it's ridiculous the amount of money that they ask. Sometimes, and you still go out and look for an article, and I find, you know, they're $30 to read this article, $29.99, $19.99. Sometimes up to $60 for a single article for a single, you know, you get to download it and have it, but it's, you know, a single download. And I have never been able to get that into my head and like and do it. I'm like, okay, time to go to the library and get my copy card. I'm going old school. If I really want an article, that's what happens. I'm not going to pay $60. So, you know, maybe the scientific journals can learn a little bit of something, you know, with this whole world of how people are willing to pay for media and what they're willing to spend and how it's going to happen. You know, maybe the newspaper industry, the media content industry can learn a little something from the scientific journals by checking to see how many people actually do download those articles for that amount of money.
It's,
you know, maybe there's something that can be learned.
I would like to see a study, and not this one that we cited earlier, but I would like to see sort of there are all these media companies right now that have these sort of ad labs set up. ESPN has one where it's sort of testing. It's actually using biometrics to gauge your actual, you know, your brain waves and your emotional response to different types of ads across online, mobile, on air, et cetera, to really gauge kind of how you're responding to the type of ads and therefore what works. It would be interesting to see, and Starcom, the media agency, is doing something similar. It'd be interesting to include the idea of payments and our receptivity to different levels and the time sensitivity at what point in the news cycle and for what type of news and for what type of deeper research and information, you know, would we pay all of these different amounts for? But yeah, I do think there needs to be some sort of universal system. But this is not an idea that is unusual. This isn't this whole idea of standards and kind of a universal system, I think, is something that a lot of industries are struggling with. And I think this is something that the online video business, going back to our earlier conversations about Hulu, is struggling with, is that a lot of ad buyers have said that they can put more money into online video. And that includes sites like Hulu, as well as, you know, Felicia Days, The Guild, and sort of individual, you know, more independent entrepreneurial type of voices, if there are standards for formats, for video players, for metrics, for reporting. But then it comes back to, well, who leads this? You know, and again, I know a lot of the stuff we're talking about right now is just kind of, you know, we're talking about what we want and it's all hypothetical. But I don't know if getting so many different groups together to agree on standards is a very challenging thing. So I don't know if we're going to get there when it comes to online video. I mean, so to segue briefly to that topic, I mean, do you think, Chuck, do you see when people talk about, you know, kind of the need for there to be some kind of standards across the online video business? And I don't know how, you know, how much or how little you've looked into this area, so I'm kind of throwing this at you blindly. But do you see that actually being a realistic goal? Do you see websites, web publishers, web programmers, independent and big media being able to get together with all of the different tech vendors and the ad bureaus and standards body and whatnot to actually come up with anything? Or does that kind of take away from what actually is working so far about web video?
I don't think there's much chance of it happening. And I think it has to happen. I mean, that's the thing.
Why does it have to happen, Chuck?
Because I can always go somewhere else and get a lot of the same, a lot of the same content. It may not be with the author I like or the host I like or hostess I like, but I can go and get the content. And, you know, I think the only thing that might trump content, or if it doesn't trump it, is right up there, is convenience and accessibility. And every time you put up a wall, you're making it more difficult for me to get to what I want. And so I have a couple choices. I can either try to go over the wall the way you want me to, I can try to go through the wall the way I would like to, or I just go somewhere else where there is no wall. And so, you know, I think they have to figure it out. That's sort of the benefit of the micropayments model and the downfall of the subscription model. If I have to subscribe at $20, $30, $40, again, I'm going to think about it. If I can pick it up for a quarter, a dollar, $2, depending on, you know, as he was saying before about when something is accessible and how interested I am, I'm much more inclined to do that and not really think about it. But if I have to think about, well, I'm having to drop a 20 or a 50 to get access to this, and that may be just one site. That just may be the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, whatever else you happen to like. You know, then I'm locked in. Now I feel like that's the only place I should go. And I'm sure the publisher would like that if they could make me feel like that's where I should, the only place I should go, because then they can tailor their model that way. But the fact is, that's just not going to happen because there's no way that they can deliver exactly what I want. Everybody's interests are too diverse, and there are too many places, too many good places out on the web to go get it, whether it's video, audio, or, well, print's the wrong word, but journalistic content, perhaps.
Words.
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 There you go. Words.
You can just call it words. Now, speaking of words, Brian, you had an interesting story that actually Dr. Kiki wound up sending to me as well, but I'll let you introduce it. It was bending journalism's rules, and that was, I think it was the story before you went on vacation, where you talked about how you just kind of looked at, obviously, you know, the Michael Jackson coverage, but the Iran coverage and kind of how, you know, how the elections were covered and all of that, and how the rules are changing and shifting. And my question to you is, how are the rules shifting for you specifically? How are they changing for Brian Stelter? We certainly know how, you know, news outlets like CNN and Fox News and so on had to cover the election protests differently. We know that TMZ broke the story of Michael Jackson's death. But what specifically do these changes mean to you day in and day out, and then broaden out from there?
Should I take that first?
Yeah, because I want to know, like, your day in and day out as a reporter, what does it mean to you?
They're two very different but very kind of interestingly similar stories. With the Michael Jackson story, when it was reported that he was going to the hospital, that was broken by paparazzi outlets like TMZ and X17. And I shouldn't say paparazzi directly, but it was in part because paparazzi were outside his house that the news broke. So it was coming from celebrity outlets. And then the rest of the media, the New York Times included, scrambled to catch up. TMZ was the first to say he had died an hour before anybody else, which is frankly unfathomable in this media age that an outlet would be an hour ahead of everybody else. But everybody, including the New York Times, waited for other confirmation. In fact, most other outlets went with the LA Times. Once the LA Times said Michael Jackson was dead, then everybody said Michael Jackson was dead. So in that case, you know, our standards didn't change. We were all aware of the TMZ story, but we didn't report it. However, I thought it was really interesting that in our live blog about Michael Jackson, once we knew he was at the hospital, dozens of commenters were posting saying, TMZ says he's dead. TMZ says he's dead. They had this
like,
really
don't
weird,
you know, you doofuses, that he's
right,
already dead, right?
TMZ. It's this weird situation where on the internet, he's alive. On the internet, he's dead. And on TV, he's alive. And that's what it was like for an hour. And it was stark. Then we have Iran, where most of the pictures, most of the information was coming from citizens. And in those cases, the Times has been publishing Twitter messages and YouTube videos, usually with caveats that say, we don't know what day this was taken. We think this was taken today. We think this is in Tehran. Can you help us confirm it? And I think that's a really big change for journalists who are used to operating under very different rules. But in that case, we didn't have any other choice. And I think, you know, journalists in their everyday lives are getting more comfortable citing Twitter messages, learning how to verify YouTube videos. So in that way, it's having an impact every day. But these two stories were just really dramatic examples of it, I think.
So, Brian, if you were editor of the New York Times, how would you have covered Michael Jackson's death? Would you have reported what TMZ was reporting, or would you have waited, as the paper did, for the LA Times?
I would not have reported what TMZ had reported in 2009. I think TMZ is in a very different place now than it was when it launched in 2006. I think it'll be in a very different place another 3 years from now. I think, look, as a site gets it right more and more and more, it gets more credibility. That's without a doubt. So I would, so I'm kind of couching my answer by saying in present day, you know, we're always going to want official confirmation. And until we had it ourselves, the headline on the front page said very clearly, AP reports Michael Jackson has died. You know, there's a handful of news outlets, including the New York Times, that are always going to prize that independent reporting. With that said, though, I think we have to learn how to tell the world what the rest of the world's hearing. In other words, you know, if People Magazine has something that nobody else has, I think we need to be linking to that somewhere, somehow. And I think, you know, I think we're learning how to do that. And Iran is an example of that, where nobody could ignore the YouTube videos and the tweets coming out of Tehran. And by creating this live blog that was posting these unfiltered comments, I think that's the right way to do it. And you'll notice The Guardian did that for Iran. The Huffington Post did that for Iran. There were some really colorful live blogs of what was happening. And I think it was a big step for journalists to say, hey, we're going to be the curators of all this stuff out there.
It's a learning process. That's great. I think that as much as how the news of Michael Jackson's death was broken taught us a lot about how old media may be stuck in its ways, I don't think there's going to be that immediate shift. You don't turn on a dime, but it's, again, it's what you say, that TMZ really earned its stripes. Does it continue over the next, you know, whatever the next big news event is that is in TMZ's sphere of influence, does it also prove that this was not a fluke? I mean, this has been, you know, this was a significant moment, and now we need to see if it can repeat it. And then if that happens, I think then we will see even more blurring of when events get reported and what a credible source is. And it's all part of a transitional shift. Dr. Kiki, I see you shaking your head. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I'm just thinking about TMZ as a credible source. I mean, one of the things that makes them difficult to trust is the fact that they work in sensationalism, and they work in the world of rumor mongering, you know, talking about celebrities and entertainment. And it's, you know, it's not necessarily trustworthy to begin with. And so, you know, that's not going, so they are going to have to prove themselves significantly if they want to continue to, if they want to become some kind of a credible source. They're going to have to shift the way that they report things, possibly. And then also thinking of Twitter as a source of information, I mean, there's a lot of great information on Twitter, but it's proven itself to be unreliable with, you know, false rumors being started that people have picked up and run with. And so that Twitter is still something that needs to be taken with a grain of salt as well. I like Brian's point, though, that media, that maybe the old media has taken a step forward as curators of this information. And I think it was really brilliant of them to actually split up the way that things have been reported, so that, you know, the stuff that is non-verifiable can actually, you know, can still get out there and people can see it, but it's also to be, it supplements. It's kind of like an appendix at the end of a book, giving you some additional information about the story and what actually may or may not be happening, and can let you figure out a little bit more about it. But the actual reporting they were doing did not use that information. So, you know, I think there's definitely going to be more of a blending of these things, but there's still a lot that needs to be taken into consideration.
I think it's also an acknowledgement that people want news different ways. And some people might want a daily newspaper story with the definitive Michael Jackson coverage, or the day's account from Iran. Other people might want that hourly feed that TMZ supplies, live blogs from Iran supplies. And I think what's important is that the newspapers like The Guardian and The Times are doing both now, and instead of just doing one or the other. I think that's a big step. The other thing about TMZ is that they pay. They pay for tips. They acknowledge they pay tip fees. They say that's different from paying for a story, because if you pay for a story, people will make their story more elaborate to make more money. But a lot of traditional journalists won't really see the difference between paying for a tip and paying for a story. That's going to make people shy away from TMZ in the mainstream media community, even though TMZ is owned by Time Warner, which also owns CNN. It's kind of a funny situation to have, you know, TMZ on one hand of Time Warner, CNN on the other, and CNN won't admit TMZ exists. It's a really interesting kind of setup.
The whole idea of being
it's the ugly stepsister,
right? Yeah, the bastard stepsister, right? That's what TMZ is. Exactly. And of course, I think it's just, I just want to, you know, make sure to point out to our viewers and our listeners that, you know, we're not talking about Michael Jackson so much as you know, as a news story, but more about what the implications for the future for media. I mean, obviously we know that this is something that I'm not implying that our, you know, the Twim listeners are huge Michael Jackson fans and they're salivating over every detail. That's not why we're covering this or why we're talking about it. You know, we're talking more about sort of the techniques and what we've learned from it. And a final note on that is that Jeff Jarvis of Buzz Machine, you know, really, really well noted professor and also sort of media chronicler, pointed out, he did, I think, use some Google Trends in his blog and pointed out that he said, you know, when Michael Jackson died, I wondered how quickly the conversation about him would fade online and how long it would persist on TV news. And he had some really interesting graphs. If anybody wants to see those, just, you know, email me or Twitter me and I'll reply with the link to his piece, where it just showed sort of the divergence that the buzz died off fairly quickly online while it continued to be covered on TV. So on that note, I'm going to shift gears to another topic. Now, late last week, this is a pretty interesting story for the future of the DVR and what can and can't be done with it. Basically, late last week, a lot of news outlets reported this, and I've got a Variety article in front of me, that the Supreme Court ruled that Cablevision could continue to go forward with its remote DVR service. This is a case that's been going obviously through the various levels for some years now, and essentially, we had a number of studios, Disney, News Corp, CBS, Time Warner again, NBC Universal, were suing Cablevision to block its rollout of a remote DVR service on the grounds that it would violate copyright laws. And essentially, excuse me, what a remote DVR service is, it's kind of like a DVR that's stored in, I guess, essentially like the cable system's head end, so that you could theoretically access, you know, everything, and it doesn't just have to be what's in your DVR. So you don't actually have to hit record, that you can just kind of tap into it and access it. Is that for my guest host, is that a good description? Anybody want to add anything to that?
No, well, there's a potential for it to be used that way. I think Cablevision was trying to be a little more cautious and say, this is a way for you to have your own DVR separate from everybody else's, but on our computer, so you don't have to rent a box from us. So basically, every cable box would be a DVR. Cablevision didn't ever say they would allow you to watch any show on any channel at any time, but that's the kind of terrifying vision.
It's that sort
that
of start again that Time Warner allows. It's that if you tune into a show in 15, you know, or start over. I'm sorry, it's the Time Warner start over feature, right? You tune into a show, you're 15 minutes into it, and everything gets stored automatically for a certain period of time, so that if you just are getting into a show in the middle of it and you want to go back to the beginning. So I think that's kind of the idea. So what does this mean, Chuck? What are your thoughts on this? I mean, what does this mean for, you know, what does this mean for studios? Did anybody really expect that that the studios were going to win this? I don't know. I guess I kind of fall on Cablevision side on this, and not necessarily on the studios, because I just think the studios restrict a lot of things. But I don't know. Did this surprise anyone? Did it surprise you, Chuck? And what does this do for the DVR business?
Daisy, I'm just fascinated by the fact that every time something like this comes up, every single time there's some new option, the big guys say, no, no, no. We don't want this. Instead of trying to look at it and say, okay, how can we leverage this to our advantage? No, we have to stop it because it's not the way we have always done business. And I realize this sounds like a rehash of a lot of arguments, you know, the VCR, the TiVo when it first came out, video rentals, but it's the same thing. And I would think that they should be in some ways maybe congratulating the cable companies for trying to find a way to keep viewers tuning in instead of going to Hulu on the web or, you know, going to some other alternative content sources. The DVRs are out there. The DVRs are becoming more affordable. Now you have DVR hardware you can put on your computer to make it even more flexible than a TiVo in some ways. I'm just fascinated by the fact that they can't get the message that people want to use the content and consume the content when they want, how they want, as many times as they want. They still think that you should sit down at 8 o'clock at night and watch TV until 11.
I mean, it's kind of like spending time on piracy lawsuits in a way, which seem a bit frivolous, frankly. Because it doesn't really ever stop piracy.
Yeah, it's not cost effective. I mean, because the people that are technically savvy are going to find ways to do this anyway. So there's always going to be a small percentage of people who do this. And if you could expand out, and you know, if hey, if the cable companies could find a way to add another $5 to my bill a month and give me a reasonable DVR service, and I, when I say reasonable, I mean something that comes close to the TiVo experience, I might think about it. Otherwise, I'm going to go the other direction and either do it myself or just ignore what they're producing and go and get what I want, when I want it, how I want it.
Do we think that the future of the DVR lies in this sort of remote storage network access type of model? I mean, is that where in 3 to 5 years, sort of everyone that is a multi-channel subscriber, is that how we will be recording? I'm not even recording. Is that how we'll be accessing shows? I mean, it's kind of like the TV Everywhere concept. It's everything on demand on your TV, right? Brian, what do you think?
I think, look, I have a box right now. I would love not to have that $10 a month, you know, rental fee for that DVR box. However, I think they'll probably still find a way to charge me the same amount for a DVR.
I suspect they will.
I would. Then again, I would love for every household in the country to have a DVR. I think that would be a great, every cable household, be a great step forward.
Chicken in every pot, a DVR in every home.
For consumers, at least. But right. I thought it was very telling last week when Cablevision took a victory lap on this one. In their statement, instead of rubbing in the face of these networks, the statement essentially said, we want to work with you and the advertisers to insert your ads in between these DVR segments. In other words, you know, they want to be a friend of the networks now, and they want to, you know, control the insertion of the ads for these DVR episodes. So time will tell whether this is actually a positive for the consumer or whether the networks will find ways to get their ads still in front of you, even if you're trying to fast forward.
Well, and everything is kind of blending. I mean, it sort of goes back to it's a similar kind of theme in today's episode with the journalism, as well as, you know, kind of what's happening with content and with the DVR. I mean, if in the future, and we're kind of doing a little bit of a futuristic episode, you know, what we'd like to see. But again, I was saying this is very similar in concept to TV Everywhere. And for those that aren't familiar with that, that's the joint project from Time Warner and Comcast. They're going to start trialing in July with 5,000 homes and just with Turner Networks. So again, just a very small trial, but to test out the idea of taking cable programming and making it available online to paying cable subscribers. Right now, you can watch certainly some cable shows online. You can see Burn Notice on Hulu. You can see, I think, it's a good show, right? You watch that show, Colleen? Oh, I'm totally getting into that show right now. I love Jeff Donovan. So you can watch that online, and you can watch The Closer, you can watch It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, but that's a very limited selection. I mean, there are very few cable shows that are actually available, very few Food Network shows. There'll be a couple clips. I don't know if Discovery, like, I don't think you can see The Brink online. But the whole idea with this is that if you are already paying for your cable subscription, and it's a matter of giving existing subscribers more access points into a service. And if this works, and again, lots of technological, lots of business hurdles for TV Everywhere to work. It's very early. But if it works, it is this sort of great mishmash of content. I mean, just throw the scheduling out the window. It does not matter anymore at all. With this concept, it doesn't even matter if the show's on at 8, because, you know, it's probably not going to be on your DVR. It's probably not going to be accessible on TV Everywhere on the computer until 10 or whatever. It's just none of that seems like it's going to matter anymore. It's like there's just this great, you know, cauldron, and the shows are in there, and you just kind of dip in there and pick out the one you want. It's kind of like true a la carte viewing.
That sounded beautiful, by the way.
I was working on that all weekend, so... So that's our future. That's what TV is going to look like.
Mind.
It's a cauldron. And on that note, now I want to segue back. I should have discussed this one earlier. I thought this was kind of an interesting story in Politico. This goes back to the journalism conversation. And, you know, we've been touching a lot on journalism and how that's changing on TWIM recently. And, you know, we kind of go through phases on TWIM. You know, sometimes we'll talk about one topic for a while, but I just feel like this is such, you know, such an ongoing thing. But really interesting political article that said, apparently the Washington Post was, you know, handing out flyers or circulating them around or whatnot, that for $25,000 to up to $250,000, lobbyists and association executives were getting off the record, non-confrontational access to, quote, those powerful few Obama administration officials, members of Congress, and the paper's own reporters and editors. It's sort of like a salon type of thing with the CEO, the publisher, so on, you know, and this flyer said, you know, bring your organization's CEO or executive director literally to the table, interact with with key Obama administration and congressional leaders. Brian, I want to throw this to you. I don't know if this is incendiary or is simply the way business has always been done between papers and Washington. What do you think?
It certainly seemed incendiary to a lot of journalists. I don't know about the ones in Washington. It has come out since that, you know, other newspapers and news outlets also hold dinners, sometimes on the record, sometimes off. I think what happened here is that the Washington Post, like other outlets, you know, want to get into the game of conferences. They want to be holding these events. They want to be charging through the nose for registration to these events. This one, though, I think really caught people off guard because it would be off the record, because it would mix these journalists and these policymakers and these lobbyists and these government officials. And it was described as being a somewhat cozy event. I think all those factors scared, you know, made some people uncomfortable. And you know, it's very different from having an on-the-record panel featuring journalists and politicians. So Washington Post quickly backed down from this, although I think they left the door slightly open to do this in the future if the events are on the record.
Oh, so this event was kiboshed after the article ran?
Yeah, there's a letter, actually.
Yeah.
I was going to say there's actually a letter from Catherine Weymouth in the Washington Post that she's written to the readers, and she's apologizing for, she says, "I want to apologize for a planned new venture that went off track and for any cause we may have given you to doubt our independence and integrity." And she talks about the fact that there was this flyer that was distributed suggesting that they were selling access to power brokers in Washington through dinners that were to take place at my home. The flyer was not approved by me or newsroom editors, and it did not accurately reflect what we had in mind.
I'd like to know what should have been accurately reflected, Catherine.
She also emailed people from her personal account about this thing. So maybe she didn't see the flyer, but she was well aware of the event.
It was taking place in her house.
Let's combine this with the Washington Post ombudsman, who also wrote yesterday in the paper that he's getting more and more letters from people saying, "I'm just noticing lots of mistakes, lots of spelling errors, lots of grammatical mistakes in your paper. You know, you need to hire some more copy editors." And wow. I think that there's an interesting combination here. You know, when it comes to fact checking, when it comes to getting the facts right and the spelling right and having credibility and having trust among your audience, that's the most important thing news outlets have right now as they face these advertising problems and these revenue problems. So it was a tough week for the Post, mostly because of these salons, but also because, you know, their own readers were telling them you're getting sloppy.
I worry about the quality of journalism going forward. I really do. I mean, the outlets are paying less. This is going to start it's never been a profession where you could really get rich being a journalist, you know, unless you were on TV and got ridiculous TV anchor pay, which some of them still get and, you know, deservedly so for, you know, a Bill O'Reilly, a Keith Olbermann, or, you know, Rachel Maddow, whoever delivers, you know, really fantastic ratings and, you know, and advertisers that come with it, you know, kudos to them. But for, you know, for a lot of outlets, whether it's a paper or a trade magazine, pay in some cases is just getting slashed in half, you know, pay for freelance articles, for whatever it is. And you could have the same reporters who were getting, you know, whether it was 80 cents a word and now getting 40 cents a word, still taking that assignment. So you might be still tapping into the same quality of journalists. But I have to wonder if your pay is getting slashed, if you're as motivated to go the extra distance on a story that you were when you were getting more. And this really applies to any type of field, but, you know, we're talking about media right now. Are you still going to do everything you need to do when you're getting half of that before? And hopefully, you know, reporters are, at least to some degree. Hopefully they're not turning in things with, you know, misspellings and bad grammar and the things that the Washington Post was getting cited for. But I have to worry that, you know, that as pay keeps getting cut further and further, what that does to morale and what that in turn does to the end product. If we're just not going to be seeing the same type of things that we were seeing when pay was, you know, better. Chuck, you want to weigh in?
Yeah, Daisy, I think it's part of a shakeout. I think it's part of a shakeout that happens in business, and it happens in, now it's going to happen in the news business, where I'm not suggesting anyone has been overpaid. It's just that all the rules have changed. And so now you may have to work harder and get less. So you may have to check ways to become more efficient. You may have to learn how to use your spell checker or a grammar checker or something. And I'm being a little flip, but I think the principle applies that it's just the way it is. There are plenty of us doing a lot of things outside of media and outside of anything we're talking about here. And you find yourself putting in more hours or more effort and getting less back for it. But hey, at least you're getting something back. The alternative is zero.
And right. I think that's a good point.
If you're a journalist out there and you're not keeping up the quality and maintaining your reputation, whether you're a freelancer or on staff, you're going to be on the way out, or you're going to be looking to do something else, because there are plenty of people who are going to be willing to put in the effort that is required.
So again, that's a good point, because it does speak to the fact that we are in a shakeout right now. So for the reporters who don't feel as motivated at 40 cents a word or 20 cents a word, and who aren't as careful as they were when they were getting paid more, you may find yourself being weeded out over the next few months, 6 months to a year, or whatever it is. So maybe there will be a certain degree of sloppiness as we get to the point where there are people, you know, we're all adjusting. You know, I think there are very few people that aren't feeling some sort of pinch, and we're all adjusting to doing more with less. And it comes down, you know, it's a good point you made, though, Chuck, about efficiency. David Pogue of the New York Times did a terrific piece on this a week or two ago, because he is, you know, probably one of the most productive reporters, authors, experts out there, you know, and has 3 children and everything. So really has to know how to balance his time, writes books, does video posts, really did a terrific piece on how he is productive and how he has used technology and tools, has a program where it's sort of like intuitive typing, where you type, you know, the first 3 letters and it automatically finishes it. So, and who knows, you know, maybe we'll see more things like that. I want to touch on 2 final stories before we end the show. Very briefly, videonews.com, videonuze.com. That's my colleague, Will Richmond. We actually do a video news podcast together every week. That's kind of a shorter one than this, about 10 or 15 minutes. He did his regular quarterly roundup of venture money that was raised in the broadband and mobile video space. So he's saying that for Q2 09, 9 broadband and mobile video oriented companies raised at least $64 million. TubeMogul, ScanScout, FreeWheel, Azuki Systems, EveryZing, Grab Networks, BTV, Yumi Networks, and Nokina Networks. There's obviously additional venture funding coming into online video, but you know, he's just sort of looking at those big ones. And what's worth noting is that of the companies that have raised money over the last 3 quarters, including those ones that I just rattled off, not a single one of them is a video producer or even an aggregator of video. They're all companies, they're all the picks and shovels. So, you know, which makes sense. I mean, we kind of know who the winners are in terms of the sites, right? We know that it's Hulu and YouTube and so on and so forth. That right now, it's about companies that are delivering, you know, TubeMogul research information, you know, ScanScout, FreeWheel, helping ads be more dynamic and relevant. That, you know, for venture funding right now, that seems to be the direction where it's going in the broadband video space. So for whatever that's worth, I just wanted to bring that up. And then I wanted to, one of our fabulous listeners from Australia, Quentin Long, pointed out, he wanted to bring my attention to this very cool PR project. Now, Tourism Queensland had a promotion, a campaign, actually won several awards at the Cannes Film Festival, the Cannes Lions International Advertising Festival, for sorry, people, I'm talking too fast, which happens very frequently. But anyway, won several awards, and the campaign was for the best job in the world. And I wanted to bring this up because a couple of weeks ago, we talked about what our wonderful colleague Martin Sargent was doing to try to get this job at a winery, at Murphy Good Winery, a really good job. Unfortunately, and this was shocking to me, he was not one of the 50 finalists. I was really surprised because, you know, I think he's tremendously talented. So anyway, so Quentin sent this along to me and said, you were talking about a really good job, but you need to talk about this because this is a similar type of effort. So basically, the it was to be a caretaker of the islands of the Great Barrier Reef in Australia with a 6-month, $150,000 contract. That's in Australian dollars, that launched in January. More than 34,000 applications from almost 200 countries were received. And the UK's Ben Southall was announced as the island caretaker in early May. So he'll begin his 6-month contract on July 1st and will spend his time exploring the islands of the Great Barrier Reef and reporting back on his experiences. Yeah, that does sound like a pretty good job. So anyway, just wanted to bring that up and put that out there and make sure that I'm doing my job covering stories from other countries and not just focusing on ones here. But yeah, congratulations, Ben. And if anybody else hears of other kind of cool efforts for jobs, I mean, I think the Murphy Good winery job was just tremendously creative. They're kind of searching for a lifestyle correspondent, very similar to this Tourism Queensland initiative. So anybody out there hears of interesting initiatives like that, send that along to me. Although, you know, you might want to wait 2 weeks to send it along to me because I tend to mass delete emails when I'm on vacation. So I may be doing that. On that note, I want to go around the horn and make sure everybody knows where to find our fabulous guest. Brian, where can people find you?
Twitter.com/Brian Stelter or BrianStelter.com.
Fabulous. Dr. Kiki, where do you want people to find you?
You can find me at drkiki.tv or on Twitter. I'm Dr. Kiki. And you'll find me tonight on the Science Channel's Brink talking about the Maker Faire.
So set your DVRs or your remote DVRs or BitTorrent it. No, don't do that.
What a suggestion.
It would be worth it for Dr. Kiki. Now, question for you. Will you be able to make that available online? Do you have any online rights to that? Could you post on your blog or embed it if it comes out on, I don't know. I mean, I know Discovery has a promo channel on YouTube, so I don't know if any Science Channel content gets up there.
Yeah, I don't know if any of it gets up on their YouTube channel, but I do know that the Science Channel, Brink has its own page where they put up segments of the show, and so I just have to wait until they feel that it's time to put my segments up there, and then I can embed those. They do have a sharing, an embedding and sharing way to do that. And
okay, so cool. Well, let us all know about that. And Chuck, where do you want people to find you?
They can find me at macvoicesgroup.com. That'll link to everything I do. And on Twitter as Chuck Joyner.
And Chuck, will you come back on TWIM again sometime soon?
I would love to come back on TWIM. Thanks so much for having me, Daisy. It was a lot of fun.
It was a pleasure having you. And as always, you can find me at daisywhitney.com and via email, daisywhitney@gmail.com. Watch my new Media Minute this week. We are over and out.